Rectangle, le podcast.
Claire Wadd, and I used to be one of the two partners in Sarah Records back in the 1980s and up to the mid-90s. Well, the label started, it grew out of the fanzine scene, really. It was myself and Matt Haynes, and we had both run fanzines for, I don't know, about 3 years or so, I guess, at that point, and then had both on different scales and in different ways been involved in putting flexi-discs out as well. So my last fanzine had had a flexi-disc with it, which was the Sea Urchins and the Groove Farm. And Matt had been one of four fanzine writers running the Charlotte La Flexi label, which did eight different flexi-discs. And again, one of those had been the Sea Urchins. And we were both living in Bristol and had met. I'd tried to flog him a fanzine at a gig, actually, is how we met. And then I'd tried to figure out from him how much 1,000 flexi-discs weighed to see if I could get them on the coach back to Leeds, okay, because I was a student in Bristol. And we got together and became a couple and set up a record label within the space of a few weeks, actually. So that made the Sea Urchins the obvious choice for the first record, and they were up for doing a record with us. The next record was The Orchids. They were another band who'd done a Charlotte La Flexi. The Poppyheads had Another Sunny Day. I think Harvey, who was Another Sunny Day, had sent Charlotte La a demo just before they stopped. So we sort of had a ready-made list of bands we really, really wanted to put records out by. And off we went. In terms of the concept, it was very much a 7-inch single label, and it was very much... I was thinking about this at the weekend, actually, because I did quite a lengthy interview for the Sarah documentary, and you always think of the stuff you wish you'd said afterwards. So here's the bit I wish I'd said in the Sarah documentary, which was that it was really run for the fans. And one of the questions I got asked on Sunday was, you know, whether I felt that record labels weren't necessarily run for the bands and in the best interest of bands. And thinking about that afterwards, I think that is a fair accusation for us, because we really were about what we would want as record buyers from a record label. So it was all about value for money. It was all about, you know, not messing about with the formats, so you had to buy things several times over. And it was all about just giving something extra and something special. So we try to put posters in or leaflets or something fun to read on the bus home, and just really caring about what it was like to be on the receiving end of it, really, with a heavy dose of socialism and feminism thrown in.
Look at the mountains I've crossed, running around in the frost, running around in the frost. Wow, 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 wow. Wow, 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 wow. Take your shady bait to save me from falling.
It was totally plucked out of the air, to be honest. I mean, I guess, you know, you look back and I think it was a reaction to the times as well, because I guess it was just on that cusp of kind of a bit of lad rock, that whole kind of Grebo thing that I think then became the kind of 90s sort of loaded thing in a way. That's probably unfair on some of the Grebo bands, but it was almost sort of which side of the fence are you on? And record labels were run by boys as well, so we were, I guess, making a point about that. It was actually, I was reading Emma at the time, Jane Austen, so it kind of came from, if a book can be called Emma, then a record label can be called Sarah. But it was never really meant to be Sarah Records, it was just meant to be Sarah, but that was too difficult. I mean, that was always the point. I think we were always a bit miffed. We never got kind of any, or we never now get any kind of references in the whole kind of Riot Girl thing, because I think we were very much part of that ethos. I mean, I guess the music was slightly different. Obviously, Heavenly were connected with it. But funnily enough, I'm just reading the Tracy Thorn autobiography as well, and she's coming very much from a similar direction, it seems to me, sort of 5 or 6 years earlier, that you're, you know, putting out quite gentle music, you're quite a tough woman, and people find that a sort of difficult mix somehow. So, you know, you have to stomp about making a point about feminism whilst being quite shy. So. We were kind of anti-everything in a way, though, I think. We were a bit on our high horse and uncompromising. So it was very much about what we didn't want to do that other labels did, even though the bit we probably weren't saying was that they were the labels we liked and admired. So, you know, undoubtedly we were influenced by Creation and Factory. I think coming from Bristol, it's hard not to have seen what Martin Whitehead was doing with Subway and be influenced by that, you know. And he'd just proved that you could be a kid, as he was then, really living at his parents' house and be selling quite big quantities of records, really. So you know, that was an example to follow. I mean, there were a lot of indie labels around at the time, perhaps fewer than a decade earlier, or maybe not quite a decade, but the early 80s. But it was kind of, you know, both the sort of... People don't really associate Sarah with punk rock, but I think that whole DIY attitude and ethos we very much carried on, even though very different music, obviously, or a lot of the music very different. But it was just like the arrogance of youth. I mean, I was 19 when we started Sarah, and you just kind of think you can, if you want to set up a record label, you just set up a record label. You know, I wouldn't do it now. I'd kind of go away and have a long, careful think about it and draw up a business plan or something. But, you know, we just decided we'd start a record label because that's what you did if you were a kid into music who never wanted to be in a band and couldn't play. So I think, you know, the whole generation, you know, of a decade before has really influenced us. But, you know, musically it was very much the Creations, the Factories, the, I suppose, the sort of 4ADs, the Rough Trades, you know. We'll be right back.
do is be crucified, crucified by those who are unloved. My feelings are hurt so easily. That is the price that
it was always just the two of us. There was a while when we were, well, probably a few years when we were kind of struggling to do everything. And, you know, we worked from home and we were a couple, so we just kind of worked pretty much all the time, really. But we thought for a while about trying to get a third person, but it was really hard to know, because it was such a personal label, it was quite hard to know how to bring a third person in and who could that be. And then, in a way, a lot of what we'd want them to do would probably have been the mail order, and we used to put letters in when we wrote to all the bands, when we sent records out, we used to put letters in with all of them of varying degrees of length. So in some ways that was kind of quite time consuming and could be a chore, but at the same time that was the sort of bit that was really us, and getting the letters back was what made it worthwhile. So once you start delegating that key thing to someone else, I don't know, it just never really seemed like it would work. And I suppose the other thing is, God knows who'd wanted to come and work with or for us, you know, sort of working for a couple at home, it would be like the Archers.
Doesn't need to change at all. He captivates me easy. The hummingbird so free to do as he will.
It probably did a bit, because I guess what it did was influence the type of demos we received. So after the early days when we were aware of a lot of the bands already, and then there were some already established bands like the 14 Hours Bears who came to us, you know, the sort of bands who were getting in touch with us were often ones who liked what we'd done before. Don't know, I always think it's a little bit more diverse than a lot of people think. I mean, I think the way the press treated it was as if all the records were kind of twee, you know, fey, guitar based. You know, I remember getting a review for the first Heavenly single, which was Sarah 30, and actually Venue magazine in Bristol, and them saying sort of, you know, yet another Sarah release with a female singer, and it was our first release with a female singer, and it was number 30, you know, so people had a preconception of what it all sounded like, which I think actually it was a lot more varied than that. You know, I mean, the Golden Dawn Action Painting, they don't sound a lot like the Orchids really, or, you know, Secret Shine Eternal were kind of on that shoegazing direction. I mean, there was variety, but, you know, on the other hand, there was no reggae. We were in Bristol, there was no trip hop, you know, there was no jazz, thankfully. I think if you've got two people and our ethos wasn't like, let's put this out because we think we'll sell a load of records. Our ethos was, let's put this out because we think it's really brilliant and it will sell what it sells. So when you've got two people and both of you have to really like it, there was no kind of trade-off. It wasn't like, well, I don't like this one, but Matt does, so we'll do it anyway. And Matt doesn't like this one, but I do, so we'll do it anyway. We only did it if we both really liked it. And I guess, you know, in your Venn diagram way, that narrows stuff down quite a bit, really.
What are you saying?
I love you.
I
often they came to us, particularly sort of once we were established. A lot of them came through demo tapes. Heavenly we approached because obviously we knew them from Tulu the Gosh Days, or Matt did particularly. But no, I mean, a lot of them were tapes later on. I mean, we were quite antisocial and insular, really. So whilst we went to gigs in Bristol, we didn't, you know, we weren't kind of social butterflies, kind of, you know, part of some scene or something. So unless people got in touch with us, I'm trying to think how it worked with different bands, actually. So Heavenly we knew. There were other bands we approached, definitely. I mean, people like Even As We Speak, we'd heard from John Peel, they already had a record out. We licensed it for the UK. The Springfields, their record came out in the States, their first one, and again, we licensed it for the UK. Sort of. Boy Racer was from seeing them live. Leeds band, and they played with a couple of our bands in Leeds. So it's a bit of a mix, really. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like that kind of Alan McGee goes to King Tut's and gets blown off stage by Oasis. We were probably at home folding bits of paper in half, you know.
So the leaves touch the ground of a bowling green in Acton. It's a place where my feet know which way to go. You can hear the trees sigh as they watch the lovers pass them. If my hands could reach you now, I would not let go. Because in Gunners Park nothing changes, no, nothing changes my whole mood. In Gunners Park I'm still waiting, I'm waiting here for you. These are sacred remains near the pond and the ice cream shop, but no one else knows what secrets we buried here.
I suppose we were in that place where, you know, records weren't selling what they had done a decade before, when people would put out an indie single and they'd just press 10,000 to start with. We would put out a single and, well, in the early days we pressed 1,000 to start with, later we'd press 3,000. And I think now, kind of, you know, time's moved on and unfortunately people probably press a couple of hundred, you know, so that's continued. So we thought, you know, times were quite tough and life wasn't what it was. In the same way as a student, I thought I was quite hard done by, you know, for whatever reason. And you look at the poor students now and clearly you're not. I think in the later days we faced the challenge that vinyl albums were definitely seemed to be kind of dying on their feet. But Sarah being Sarah, we were never going to release an album that was CD only. So everything had to come out on vinyl as well. But of course vinyl albums are way more expensive to produce than CDs, because the artwork's 10 times as big, and, you know, then they're selling at a lower price, or they were in those days. So, you know, we faced our own sort of internally imposed challenges, I suppose, quite a lot, because it was all stuff had to be done a certain way. So so, you know, things like writing letters out every time we sent a record out was a challenge, you know, arguing with photographers about putting girls at the front in the middle of the photos to make them look balanced if there was only one girl in a band, that was a challenge, you know. But you know, that's because we kind of wanted to do things our way and a very specific way, and I guess that was what made it hard, but it was also, you know, what made it Sarah, and it was kind of an extension of us, you know, it was so personal.
Two steps back, it's a tender trap. Oh.
quite a lot of success in France. I remember coming to a Sarah gig in Brussels as well, not in Liège, I'm afraid, but in Brussels. So it's difficult. In a way, success is, you know, how many records did you sell, or, you know, what was the biggest venue anyone paid? And I suppose whilst we were consistently, you know, relatively successful, and we made a living off the label for just about 8 years, I guess, or 5 years maybe, somewhere along the lines, you know, that in itself is a success from quite an uncompromising small record label. So Heavenly's, I think Le Jardin de Heavenly sold about 20,000 copies worldwide, which, you know, is relatively successful. A few of the bands went to places like Japan on tour, which was great. I think in a way, though, the thing I'm most proud of, if that's the question, is the way we ended the label when we did, and the reasons for doing it. And one of the things that drives me absolutely crazy is when people think we went bust or something like that. I mean, we always felt there were sort of about three or four different ways to end a record label, which is, you know, just to, well, one, to go bust, which happens reasonably often too, is, you know, to start putting out crap records and everyone stops buying them and you just kind of dwindle away. You could sell out to a bigger record label. And we didn't want to do any of those and just kind of get into a nice round number, because we were both a bit mathsy and a bit geeky, and throwing a big party and taking out some ads in the press saying, you know, we're basically destroying it. That I'm just so pleased we did, even though it was really hard to do, and I do miss some bits of it even, you know, even all this time later, but I'm just so pleased we did that. And, you know, we have to kind of fight a bit now. People get in touch and say, oh, I want to do a Sarah compilation. It's just like, no, you know, you can't. So that was, and it's gone, and it was of its time. And we're still friends, and we don't see each other nearly often enough, but we do still see each other. So we both ended up moving to London actually a year or so after Sarah stopped. Matt set up a label called Shinkansen, which put out the Trembling Blue Stars and a Blue Boy record, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff that wasn't from Sarah Days. And I sort of, you know, in the early days of that, I helped out a little bit in that because I missed it. And then he's gone on to do Smoke magazine, which is a London peculiar, with a woman called Jude Rogers, who's now a Guardian journalist. So he does that. So I took a very different path. I when we stopped Sarah, I'd started working prior to that because I knew we were going to stop for the company that did our distribution. So it was kind of Revolver Cartel, became Revolver APT, became Vital Distribution. So I worked there, and then I moved from that to working for a subsidiary of Virgin for a couple of years. And I was kind of sitting around trying to work out who I wanted to work for. And I got to work on some records and bands I really, really liked at this label. I got to work with Low and people like that, which was wonderful. But I also, you know, it wasn't my record label. You don't get to choose the bands. And working on stuff I didn't really like, wasn't really sure that was what I wanted to do, and I couldn't see much of a kind of career path or any sort of senior women to kind of show me where I could go next. So I ended up looking back, and I'd got an economics degree and 2 maths A levels, so I went off and trained as a chartered accountant, just for a complete. It was quite interesting resigning. There was a little bit of shock, but I was a music industry accountant for a few years, and then kind of moved into more TV side, and now I'm in a media technology side and about to move to a sort of technology charity. Mm-hmm.
was a good day for me. Can't believe I've sunk this low. Is there something in it that I don't know? It's just a matter of timing then. Big fish swallows small again. And the lamp light shining to my heart reminds me that I need a friend. You've got it.
Subsequent bands, and some have reformed over the last few years. There's been quite a lot of, I suppose, quite a lot of sort of interest, and maybe people have got to the age where they, you know, miss what they were doing in their early 20s or whatever and want to do it again, or they're happy to play those early songs again that, you know, embarrassed them for however long. So the Orchids are back together and actually playing in London next month, which I'm looking forward to. Heavenly, well, they split up. Matthew, their drummer, committed suicide. I was going to say quite soon after Sarah stopped. That rather implies some connection, which there absolutely wasn't. So some of the people from that band were in, actually they were all in Marine Research, and then some of them are in Tender Trap. Amelia and Rob are in Tender Trap, and Pete plays with the Would Be Goods and a couple of other bands. Field Mice, where Bob went on to be, Northern Picture Library, and then Trembling Blue Stars. Beth from Aberdeen was in Trembling Blue Stars as well. I'm not sure if they put out their last record or if they're carrying on. I think I had heard it was going to be their last, but I don't know. So it's sort of different people, different things, really. Some have reformed, some called it a day, some carried on, you know. I think it must have been quite awkward for them. No one really expects their record label to kind of throw in the towel. So I can't imagine it was great for them, really. We kind of kept it a secret as best we could, so it was probably quite a shock to some of them as well. So all about the fans and not about the bands, you see. So. I know bands like Painted Being Pure at Heart and The Drums have certainly name-checked some of the bands on Sarah. You know, I think there's a bit of a resurgence of maybe the style of a lot of the music. And obviously indie labels and ethos continues. So I don't know, it's so long ago now. I mean, it's 17 years since we stopped Sarah. It's just like a whole couple of generations, really, isn't it, of kids. So I think, I feel at the moment there seems to be quite a lot of interest, and whether it's someone's making a documentary and someone's writing a book. And I think, you know, that sort of interest reinforces each other. So I've got sort of, you know, this interview and a couple of others to do at the moment. But, you know, I could have gone a year without doing an interview maybe 5 years ago. But I think once one person starts writing about it, other people do as well. I think maybe we're also at that age where people who were really influenced by the label, and there seems to be a particular sort of, maybe boys who were kind of 15 or so when they heard their first Sarah stuff, and they were quite sensitive young men, and it kind of spoke to them in a way that different music didn't, and they got letters from us. I think some of those people are in kind of relative positions of power or authority or whatever that keeps it in the media eye a bit. You know, people who are maybe 5 years younger than me or so, but much more successful.
Rectangle, le podcast.